Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller Podcast. Friday is upon us. It's the 6th of September, 2019. Yes, Friday is upon us. I'm Derek Hunter. I'm your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for spreading the word, telling a friend, and all that good stuff. We only grow because of you. And God, I really appreciate all of it, all the word of mouth and all the emails that you get me. And you can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, and confess your deepest, darkest secret. Don't confess your deepest, darkest secrets. But you can say hello, say what you like about the show, say what you hate about the show, whatever you got. And I will read it and probably respond to it. We have an amazing program today. A returning champion, if you will, Sean Parnell. Sean Parnell was on the show, it's Friday, it's our video edition. Sean Parnell was on the show a year ago when he came out with his first novel, Man of War. And I thought he was a cool guy. We hit it off. We drank beers on the show. And I kept in touch with him. And now he's out with his second novel, All Out War, and I cannot recommend it enough. We get into that. We get into his service in Afghanistan, what he thinks of the war in Afghanistan, whether or not we can win it, whether or not we did win it. He thinks we won it in the past, and then, of course, blew it because politicians always ruin everything. So we get into all sorts of things with Sean, including a six-pack of beer. It's a good time. I will warn you now that we're dealing with an Army Ranger and a couple of beers in me. So the language gets a little bit saucy in spots, but hey, what are you going to do? Do yourself a favor is what you should do and order a copy of Sean's book. You'll be inspired to do it at the end of the program, so you might as well get it over with now. But we have a few minutes to spend together before we get to the interview because the show's going to be roughly an hour. And that's what I promised you, and that's what I deliver. But first, I got to tell you about our great sponsor. Joining me on the phone right now is Ronnie McMullen. Not only is he the Grand Poobah over at Life Change Tea, he's also the Grand Poobah of Ancient Life Oil, the CBD oil. Ronnie, CBD is wildly popular right now. Tell people what it is.
My CBD is from hemp extract. So it is an incredible product, natural product. I don't have any THC, so there's 0.003 or less THC, which that's the psychoactive drug that makes you high. My CBD will not make you high, but it will do great things for things like inflammation. It'll do great things for sleep, for anxiety. It'll do great things. There are people that have such a hard time sleeping and they take a dropper full or half a dropper full and they sleep like a baby. We have a salve, and I always tell people, and I usually put a special together with a salve and a tincture, which is the little bottle that helps everybody feel good. I usually put it together, and the reason I do is because the salve is the outside and the tincture is on the inside. So the salve, when you put the salve on your body, on a painful place, an elbow, a back, neck, whatever, and you put it on, you'll see the pain go away within 15 minutes. And people go, wow, that really works. It's exciting. This is great. So if you think that's what it does on the outside, what's it doing on your inside? So it's a great product.
Well, you can find out for yourself what it's doing on the insides and the outsides at ancientlifeoil.com. A-N-C-I-E-N-T, lifeoil.com, all one word. Enter promo code Derek at checkout. You get free shipping. Ronnie, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you more about CBD oil in the future. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's ancientlifeoil.com. Don't forget promo code Derek at checkout for free shipping. All right, on to the news of the day. I've got some stories that I want to get to that I wasn't able to get to for the rest of the week. And I thought, well, you know what? I've only got a little bit of time before we get to the Sean Parnell interview, which is probably my favorite interview that I've ever done. And I've done a lot of interviews on this show, as you know. So I thought we'd go back and we'd look at some of the things I wasn't able to get to in the week. And we start off with former Vice President Joe Biden. He was in South Carolina the other day. And I don't, it's hard to tell. It's getting harder and harder to tell whether or not something is a gaffe that Joe Biden says, or if he's just crazy or dumb. It's always been a crapshoot with Joe Biden, whether it was crazy or dumb. Now you've got to throw in the added, is he losing it? You know, you got to toss in the salad mix of possibilities for Joe Biden. Like, is that guy, is he finally losing his mind? He was talking about illegal immigrants, more specifically young illegal immigrants, the children, the ones we hear about so desperately that the left cares more about than your kids. If you're an American, you got no place in the liberals' world. But if you're an illegal alien kid, well, they'll go to bat for you. They'll try and offer you every benefit under the sun, make sure you don't get deported, make sure your parents don't get deported, make sure you can bring family over on top of it. I mean, it gets really that crazy. Listen to what Joe Biden said about illegal alien children compared to American children. One, he thinks, is actually more of a true American, meaning citizen of the United States, or, you know, member of the society of the United States, than the other. Can you guess which one?
And these kids who come and they end up doing well, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans. No, I'm serious. They get in school. They do well. They contribute to the community. They contribute to the country.
Screw those American kids. What this country needs is more illegal alien children, because Americans are just the worst. Am I right? Am I right? Now, you say that to a Democratic crowd, and maybe you will get a whole bunch of amens. Like, yeah, totally, absolutely. God, those Americans are just the worst. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, a candidate talking about people who are in this country illegally and saying they're basically better than Americans would be out on their ass before they finish the sentence. But in 2019, not so much anymore. It's a prerequisite for the Democratic Party. It's unbelievable, these people and the things they say. And Joe Biden is crazy, and he can't help himself. But you would think that something like that would register. It didn't register. He was very earnest in his point. No, I'm serious. I'm not joking. I'm telling you the truth. Americans are awful. Give me all the illegals you got. I'll take them over those stinking Americans. When I heard that, I could not believe. I'm like, what did he just say? He has to pull up from this nosedive somehow, but he didn't. He just trucked on, and nobody in the crowd said, hey, Joe, I got American kids. You just kind of said that they suck compared to illegal alien kids. Want to explain that? But nope, nobody didn't, because the Democratic primary audience is an amen chorus. That's all they are. They're all on board. They are in for a penny, in for a pound. So, yeah, there's your Democratic Party frontrunner right there. Every once in a while, they accidentally tell you what they're really thinking. And it's never pretty. It's never good. Speaking of never pretty and never good, the city of San Francisco. Boy, howdy, San Francisco. How are you, San Francisco? The city by the bay. It is, it's infested with needles and human feces, if we're just going to cut right to the chase. Very wealthy city, but very liberal and very accepting of everything except conservatism. If you want to shoot up heroin and take a crap on the steps of City Hall, you can do that, and you will face no criminal charges for that. You want to smoke meth down by the library and take a dump in the reference section? Well, welcome to San Francisco. We're very tolerant. But if you are an NRA member, you are not welcome. Do not even try. Don't bother going to San Francisco. This story is not surprising. This one's from the Daily Caller. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors is calling the National Rifle Association a domestic terrorist organization and wants the federal government to do so too. The board passed a resolution Tuesday that KTVU reported, Political statement or not, the resolution comes at a time when the NRA faces increasing hostility from liberals, blah, blah, blah. It goes on from there. But don't you love how the Board of Supervisors, they can't get together and figure out what to do with the thousands of homeless junkies living on their streets, literally shooting up in public. And you can find video of that on social media pretty easily because many residents and tourists film it because they're shocked and disgusted by it and concerned for the human beings. The government of San Francisco is not concerned for any human beings. You can take a dump on the streets. You can smoke your meth. They're not worried about you dying. They're worried about making sure that you get a clean needle next time you shoot up, which... they don't want to get you off drugs. They want to make sure you do drugs in the most hygienic way possible, which I suppose in a really sick, bastardized version of the word is a form of compassionate, maybe? I mean, you should never be this compassionate, in quotes, toward anybody you love, toward anybody you actually care about. But it's interesting that this is what San Francisco's government has the time to deal with. People dying on the streets, people living on the streets, people defecating on the streets, people doing drugs on the streets, and they find time to pass a resolution calling the NRA, declaring the NRA a terrorist organization. The board also aims to prohibit people and organizations who do business with the city of San Francisco from maintaining any form of financial links with the NRA. Isn't that lovely? Again, life is all about priorities, and the priorities of real Americans are very infrequently in line with liberal Democrats. I'm being generous there. The document contends that the United States is, quote, plagued by an epidemic of gun violence. It also accuses the NRA of using its considerable wealth and organization strength to promote gun ownership and incite gun owners to acts of violence, end quote. This is the city of San Francisco. So in the spirit of the government of San Francisco, I, your humble host, Derek Hunter, will read in its entirety the list of mass shootings carried out by members of the National Rifle Association. Are you ready for it? Here we go. And there it is. There has not been a single mass shooting carried out by a member of the NRA, yet the left wants to blame not only the organization itself, but all of its members. They want a blacklist. God, liberals love their lists. Earlier this week, it was the cast of Will and Grace wanting a blacklist of anybody who might think differently in Hollywood so that they might be able to ruin their lives. And now the city of San Francisco is declaring that they will not do business with anybody who does any form of business with the National Rifle Association. Now, I wonder, what if somebody is a member of the NRA and a citizen of San Francisco? Would they strip their citizen rights? They'd probably like to deport them. It's kind of funny. San Francisco is a sanctuary city, of course, welcoming of all people except conservatives. So it wouldn't surprise me if these people just said, screw it, and you, I'm not interested in what you have to say. You might as well not even be an American. You disgust me. Take your petty little problems and go. That's the world they're creating. It's the world they're living in. They're going to force the rest of us to live in it. I swear to God, these people should never be anywhere near power whatsoever. Speaking of crazy liberals near power, here's another story. From Chicago, another liberal bastion. Democrats have controlled the city of Chicago completely for more than 60 years. Republicans haven't even stood a chance of having power. I don't even know if they bother trying anymore. But the new mayor of the city has a novel culprit, shall we say, when it comes to the city's nonstop, unaddressed by any politician, gun violence that they have. The new mayor of Chicago is Lori Lightfoot. And the big news that she made when she was elected is that she's the city's first female lesbian, black lesbian. Like, who cares? She's a crazy leftist who has no freaking clue or concern what to do about the mass shootings that happen every day in Chicago. Well, she responded to Senator Ted Cruz on Twitter. Ted Cruz had pointed out some universal truths about gun ownership, the Second Amendment, liberty, things like that. All these things that liberals hate. So Lori Lightfoot took to her Twitter account to respond to Ted Cruz. She thought she had herself some gold, fully mined. She tweeted, quote, 60% of illegal firearms recovered in Chicago come from outside Illinois, mostly from states dominated by coward Republicans like you who refuse to enact common sense gun legislation. Keep your name out of our mouth, or keep our name out of your mouth. That's a wildly popular thing for leftists to say nowadays. Keep my name out of your mouth. Well, then keep your blood off our streets. How about that? You know, keep your blood off our hands. It's all on you, honey. I hate to break it to you. And then she has a list. Ooh, 40% of the guns were bought in Illinois, and then the rest were bought in other states, most notably Indiana, with 21%. Now, these are the guns that were caught, 21%. These are the guns that were traceable, that were caught on the streets of Chicago. And she thinks, well, I've got a gun now. Well, you can't buy a gun in Chicago. I don't believe Chicago has any gun stores whatsoever. It's nearly impossible to legally own a firearm in the city of Chicago. Now, by liberal logic, that would make it the friendliest, most peaceful, safest place on the earth. It's Disneyland on Lake Michigan. But, of course, it is not. However, the Lori Lightfoot tweet is not dumb because of that. It's dumb because if all of these guns are flooding into Chicago and causing the violence in Chicago, the gun itself, then why aren't the places, the states from which these guns are alleged to have come, cesspools of murder? Random murder, drive-by shootings, drug shootings, whatever it is. They are not. There is no city in Indiana comparable to what's going on in Illinois. There is no city in really any state in the country, with the possible exception of Baltimore, that has, and again, it's another Democrat-controlled city, that has anywhere near anything that's going on in the city of Chicago. So, what does it matter where the guns are coming from? Shouldn't the concern be what's wrong with the people of Chicago? What has gone wrong in Chicago? And then you have to probably deal with the breakdown of the family. And no one wants to deal with the breakdown of the family. Liberals never want to deal with the breakdown of the family. They're the ones who tell you that family is whatever you want it to be. Anybody can possibly be your family. Well, having a good group of friends really is nice, and it makes life more enjoyable and better and less stressful and all that good stuff. However, no matter how good your friends are, it will never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, replace good parenting. And parents being plural, two of them, a mother and a father, having one of each, or even just two people, I don't even care, but having two parents there, raising you, holding you to standards, disciplining you, instilling the difference between right and wrong in you, is irreplaceable. No government program will ever take the place of good parenting. Bad parenting leads to horrible things. So when you look at the out-of-wedlock birth rate in Chicago, particularly the south side of Chicago and the west side of Chicago, or if you look at the single mother rate in that area, you begin to see a massive breakdown in what actually helps raise sane, good, rational, decent members of society. Now, to really address the problem of violence in Chicago, you would have to acknowledge that while family is family and you can make your family whatever you want, no configuration decided externally and compiled out of convenience and or necessity will ever replace the parenting structure that comes in nature. But Lori Lightfoot doesn't want to talk about that. She can't talk about that. She would lose a lot of voters. She would alienate a lot of her constituents. So it's more politically advantageous for her to attack a senator from Texas who's pointing out universal truths than it would be to tell universal truths to her constituents. Tell me again, which is the evil party? I can't remember. And finally today, before we get to Sean Parnell, this story just takes the cake. When I first saw this, I thought, this is where we're headed as a society. This is not in the United States, though, thankfully, yet. It will be, don't worry, because stupidity spreads like a cold on a plane. Newsweek, headline, vegan takes neighbors to Supreme Court for cooking meat and fish in their backyard. It's as dumb as the headline would indicate. An unusual neighborhood dispute between a vegan and meat eaters ended up in the Supreme Court of an Australian state, according to reports. Celia Carden, a vegan massage therapist, of course. You know, is there any massage therapists who eat meat? Lives in a suburb of Perth, was angry with the fish and meat smells coming from the barbecue in her neighbor's backyard. Quote, they've put the barbecue there, so I smell fish. I don't know, that's not a good Australian accent. So I smell fish. All I can smell is fish. I can't enjoy my backyard. I can't go out there, Carden told the local news. Health-conscious Carden has also taken issue with neighbors smoking cigarettes in their garden because she says the fumes waft into her backyard, and Carden says she is fed up with the neighbor's children playing basketball and making noise. Now, doesn't Celia Carden just sound like a lovely person? She sounds like she would work for Elizabeth Warren, to be perfectly honest with you, or Bernie Sanders. But this insufferable, and I'm looking at her, not something you want to do. Don't look up the picture of it. But she's the bastion of health and healthy eating and living, allegedly. You would never know it, but this is where we're headed as a society. Used to be, you know, live and let live. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. You do you. What you do is fine. I'll do me, and we'll just agree to disagree or whatever. Now it is, you have offended me, and therefore you must be destroyed. You are the problem because you exist wrong in my eyes. This is the busybody leftist syndrome. And it's not, that part is not contained to Australia. It is everywhere here in the country, especially in academia. And now they're entering the workforce. I fear for the country we are going to leave my children and your children. It's going to be hell on earth. And it's all going to be thanks to the tolerant leftists who really are just complete and total fascists. All right. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening. Email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. I really just wanted to blow through this because I wanted to get to the Sean Parnell interview. I don't listen to interviews that I conduct because I always think, oh, I should have said this or I could have talked about that. Not this one. This interview I listened to. This interview is fun. This interview is informative. And you should definitely, absolutely, 100% go to your computer right now or your local bookstore and order a copy or buy a copy if you're at the bookstore of All Out War. I got the audio version and it's just like hearing a movie. It's amazing. So if you're into that, go that route. Anyway, here comes Sean Parnell. I'll see you guys again on Monday. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Friday edition of the Daily Caller podcast. It is the 6th day of September, 2019. Summer's over, but that doesn't mean you don't have to get, you have to get it out of your head and have a summer read. And that is the focus of our guest today. His name He's a returning champion, as a matter of fact. It's Sean Parnell.
I am a returning champion.
You've been here before. We got our beers. Yours is already open.
Bud Light, your favorite beer.
We tried to get
Bud Light for you.
Cheap Western Pennsylvania swill, but the liquor stores around the Daily Caller offices have standards. Not high standards, clearly, but standards nonetheless.
If you wanted, you should have gotten some Iron City beer, man. I'm from Pittsburgh. You know I love that stuff.
The trick is if I wanted, and I did not. Sean Parnell, he's the author of the best-selling book, Outlaw Platoon. He's the author of Man of War, which is what we talked to him about last year. And now the new thriller out just last Tuesday called All Out War. This last Tuesday, because this is the Friday. We're doing this. This is for next Friday.
Oh, my God. Do we have to re-record all
How
that?
How many beers are you in?
I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter. We show these
you
people the ugly thing.
I'm too stupid for all this.
You know what? Skip it. Show's over. Have a great weekend.
I'm sorry. I just totally.
You've had one and a half beers.
I totally fucked up
your whole intro. former Army Ranger and one and a half Bud Lights put you on your ass?
I should have thought.
Kids today. I don't have
a tolerance for beer. I'm sorry.
No wonder we can't win wars. People like you are out there fighting them. All right, I want to talk to you. It's an Eric Steele novel. It's your character. It's you. It's what you want to be when you grow up.
Yes.
It's pretty clear. He lives in the Pittsburgh area. He drinks Line and Kugel. He loves the Pittsburgh Steelers, which we don't hold against you, but it's still true.
It is true.
After Man of War. Well, first of all, I want to talk to you about the process before we get into All Out War.
Sure.
You go from, it's kind of a memoir of your time in Afghanistan in an outlaw platoon. What brings you to the world of fiction? Because I imagine this is, you know, it's a substantial book.
Yeah.
But I assume you have more stories. And people tell you more stories. If even you didn't have more stories yourself, you could have written other people's stories. But you decided to take that turn into fiction.
Well, so when I got back from Afghanistan, I realized something very, very quickly. And that was that there is a huge gap between the people that enjoy freedom on a day-to-day basis in this country and the people that protect it. I mean, I can't tell you. I've got countless stories from my guys who had come back from the war and then come back from their R&R, rest and relaxation leave, back to Afghanistan and say, you know, sir, oh my gosh, like Americans would ask, like, where were you deployed? And I'd answer Afghanistan. And they'd be like, oh my God, you're in Afghanistan. Thank God you're not in Iraq. It's just so dangerous there. And so my guys are like, Jesus Christ, I just got shot in the head last week. So something that became very apparent to me very quickly was that Americans don't know what's going on there. Right. And so I came back from Afghanistan thinking that I need to do something to capture the legacy of my troops. And that to me was, I've got to figure out a way to write a book and have it published the right way so that their heroism on the battlefield can be remembered and passed down from generation to generation to generation. And when Outlaw Platoon came out, I feel like no one expected the book to do well. I mean, I'm proud of this book. I put everything I had into this book. But I was a no-name guy jumping into a nonfiction world that untested waters for me. And it came out, and it was a New York Times bestseller in its first week and spent 28 weeks on the bestseller list in its first year, which is unbelievable. No one saw that coming. No one was more surprised than I was. And so after the book came out, I realized how much needed to be done for our men and women who are coming home from war. And so I dedicated my life to it. I've got a great charity that I work with. I'm part of a great charity that I work with that educates, inspires, and
you
gives
can
back.
Name them.
They're the American Warrior Initiative. We give service dogs to vets. It's awesome. We've been doing it for 6 years. But the more I worked in this area, the more I realized most Americans don't understand what our veterans go through on a day-to-day basis. And so I started trying to brainstorm ideas of how I could educate, you know, mainstream America about what makes the American warrior tick. And so I started thinking, you know, I've always loved fiction. I've loved it my whole life. It's always been a dream of mine to write fiction. Like, you know, I never thought I could actually do it. But then I started thinking, okay, probably one of the best, most effective ways I can help educate Americans on what makes the American warrior tick is by writing mainstream fiction and write a character that embodies the greatness that I witnessed in my shoulders on the battlefield every day. And that character is Eric Steele, right? So again, I'm a Pittsburgh guy. His last name is Steele. There is a coincidence there. I don't care how much you hate the Steelers. I love them.
I don't hate them. So much so that
America loves the Steelers, yeah. But I don't want to digress
Jerry
too much.
Jones is on the phone.
Well, so Eric Steele embodies the greatness of the American soldier on the battlefield. He's written in the image of my soldiers. And so he's a good guy. He's a good character. He wants to do right by not only the people that he serves with, but also by this country that he loves.
But you talk about, and it's admirable, you want to tell these stories that the American people and mostly the media, because the American people can't fly over to Afghanistan and see what's
correct,
going on.
Correct.
It's the media that's supposed to inform the public, and they aren't. But you didn't set the Eric Steele novels in the war. It's
right.
It's in this sort of spy sort of the Alpha. Describe what the Alpha program is.
Yeah. So the Alpha program, I wrote the Alpha program in the image and structure of the U.S. Green Berets Special Forces. So U.S. Special Forces teams, there's a team assigned to a different geographic area of the globe. Every Special Forces team speaks that language and they immerse themselves in that culture. And their mission is foreign internal defense. So they specialize on training indigenous troops to take the fight to their corrupt governments to basically promulgate freedom all around the world. So the Alpha program is basically the singleton operator version of that, where the Alpha program is there are nine alphas, each responsible for a different geographic area of the globe. And those alphas are the most highly trained operators from every branch of government or every branch of the military in our country. And Eric Steele is the youngest alpha. And these alphas, once you make it into the Alpha program, once you make it through the rigorous training process,
you're wiped out of existence.
You're ghosted. Yeah, you're wiped out of existence. Your name is taken off the books. Your social security number is taken off the books. And you report directly to the president of the United States.
So they can have plausible deniability,
correct,
much like every girl I ever dated wants. They wipe me out of their existence. And they say, "Who? I'd never heard that name before."
Well, yes. Yeah, so... yeah, so Eric Steele is ghosted. He's brought into the Alpha program. He's the youngest, most talented alpha in American history. And the whole reason I came up with this is there were times in Afghanistan where we were in eastern Afghanistan in 2006. This was at a time where the eyes of the nation were wholeheartedly fixated on the Iraq war. We were sort of just left to handle it. And it was basically like we were just – our mission was to close with and destroy the enemy, find Osama bin Laden, capture or kill him. That was it. So – there'd be times where we'd be sitting out there on random outposts in Afghanistan or traffic control points in Afghanistan, and we'd know where the high value target was. We'd know where the super, super bad guys were, right? But then we'd have to pass it up the chain of command. They'd have to talk to different areas of government. And then by the time the approval authority came down and we were given the green light to go get this guy, he'd already be gone.
Right.
And so it was the most maddening thing in the world, especially when you're in the midst of heavy combat and a counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, that is Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. You want to take the fight to the enemy and win. We never really had that opportunity to go after high-value targets. We never had the flexibility to do it either. And so I just said, you know what? I'm going to create a fictional program that there's no bureaucratic red tape. The president says, go and fix a problem. Alphas are left to figure it out, fix the problem in any way that they see fit, as long as it's in keeping with the best interests of the United States. And so that's what the Alpha program is, and that's what Eric Steele is a part of.
So after Man of War, Eric Steele's in rough shape. He's seen better days.
He's lost a lot, yeah.
He's lost a lot, and physically, he's had the hell beat out of him.
He has.
And so we pick up right there. This is what, 6 months after?
6 months later, yeah. And so one of the things that I wanted to do with Eric Steele is not make him a superhero. Mm-hmm. Like when he gets hit, it hurts. He gets shot in the sappy plate in his body armor in the first book. He breaks his ribs. And this book picks up with him recertifying. And so, you know, if the Alpha program were a real U.S. government program, a soldier was wounded on the battlefield, he'd have to be retrained, recertified before he would be allowed to be operational again. And that's where this book picks up. And he recertifies, he passes recertification. And the first thing he does is go to have dinner with his mother. And all the while, like what I tried to do with Eric Steele is make him face the same dilemmas that our U.S. troops face on a day-to-day basis. And so what I mean by that is he constantly questions the mission. He says, you know, is the cost of this mission worth it? Like when we were in Afghanistan, I can't tell you how many times I asked myself, I got guys getting wounded, shot in the head every single day. Is this worth it?
was your conclusion?
In Afghanistan, I concluded that it was, because there are little kids that are smarter today, smarter now than they were before we were there. There are little girls that can read now. And I think all of that bodes well for the future of the country when if the populace is more educated. Are we winning the war there? It really depends what your definition of win is, because, or the definition of victory, because we win every battle that we're in on the battlefield, but somehow we're losing the war politically. So,
well, is that because they say you can only go up to this point? The rules of engagement are such that, yes, if there's a possibility of one civilian casualty, then you can't do that mission.
Derek, I'll tell you right now, in 2006, I will take this to my grave. The war was won in Afghanistan in 2006, 2007. We had killed so many insurgents and high value targets that were there just in combat, just from being there for 485 days. We were getting intelligence from the Pakistani Taliban, and we were listening to their communications on their ICOM radios of the Pakistani Taliban and families in Pakistan saying, "We're done committing our sons to this fight. We're losing too many of them. We're done supporting you." And then we left. President Obama took office. The strategy changed from counterterror, which is close with, destroy, kill the enemy, to counterinsurgency, where we're building combat outposts everywhere at largely static positions. And when that happened, it allowed the Pakistani Taliban to consolidate, reorganize, bolster, get more troops for their mission and penetrate into the heart of Afghanistan. And after that happened, the war just became uncontrollable.
As is always the case, it's the people not in the fight who end up losing.
Well, we should have known that the Maginot Line didn't work, you know? And so just building a bunch of combat outposts in one of the most rugged areas in the face of the world, in the Hindu Kush Mountains, that rugged border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, I mean, why build a combat outpost when there are mountains that are 7,000 feet high between each one that insurgents – why would they walk past your outpost when they can just go two clicks to the south and walk right? I mean – you know, when you spread your force out along a line.
Because a bureaucrat justifying their
exactly
job
right.
in the Pentagon and Arlington.
Look, you're exactly right. Right. They're looking at a map and they're saying, look how good this would work. And that was a colossal mistake for the war in Afghanistan, for the fight in Afghanistan. And in 2007, from 2007, 2008, that was when the war started. That's when we started to lose. And let me highlight that point by saying, like, we were attacked, or the enemy tried to attack us. We built the very first combat outpost in Afghanistan at a place called Combat Outpost Margah, right on the border. The enemy tried to overrun us. We had 20 troops on the ground. They attacked us with over 300 enemy soldiers, 50 from the north, 50 coming in from the northwest, about 250 coming in directly from Pakistan. I have the Predator video of this to this day. We found them, we identified, and we killed every single one. Because our mission was to find the enemy and kill them. In the years that followed, every year that followed for the next 5 years in Afghanistan, an American platoon on a combat outpost was overrun. Every single year that followed. So we changed the mission in Afghanistan to the great detriment of not only U.S. policy goals there, but to the U.S. ground pounder in
you
Afghanistan.
You would think
too.
That the brass would recognize that, hey, suddenly things are going south.
I'll tell you why they don't, because the brass aren't the guys that have served in combat, right? They came up during the Cold War. They never actually fought in a kinetic fight. Think about it like this. Like if you're an artist and you've been trained to paint a painting, but you've never actually painted a painting, you're going to want to try to justify your career, right? And mm-hmm. These generals who came up during the Cold War, most of them, not all of them, but most of them had never been in combat or had a bullet cracked by their head. These are the guys that are writing policy for the ground pounders in Afghanistan. So guys like me, who you would hope would stay in for a whole career, having went through nonstop combat for a long time, end up getting out because they're so frustrated with the freaking process of the rules and the policy errors that experienced combat leaders don't stay in. And the guy, sort of a self-licking ice cream cone. People that have no combat experience end up in charge of combat ground pounders. The combat ground pounders get out because they're frustrated by the policy that's written by people that have never been there.
So we're a generation away of having those commanders replaced by people who actually have the experience and know what they're talking about?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, look, I would say I don't want to criticize people that put on the uniform and serve a career. I would say most of your general officers, I say most of, not all, are people that have never been there before. Because let's think about it like this. I went into the military wanting to make it a career. I was medically retired as a captain because I was wounded and I had fractured my skull in a couple different places. I went in with lofty goals and experienced the heaviest combat that any U.S. military unit has been in before. And I got back from that and I was just thinking, to hell with this, I'm done. My nine lives are up. Mm. So most guys that are in combat like me do that. They get out. They want to start a family. They don't want to sacrifice anymore because they don't know that they're going to have the opportunity to start a family in the future or just do the things that they want to do. So what happens is all your experienced guys get out and all your career guys that have never been there, right? And I'm using the term all.
We're using broad generalizations, yeah, so but everybody knows there are exceptions to every rule.
Yeah, right there. Thank you. And so, yeah, most of the time, the guys that stay in are the guys that have never been there, and those are the guys that write policy. So it's
cheery.
You see how it's like.
Oh, right. Yeah. No.
The cycle never ends.
And working in the opinion world, there are people I've had 72 jobs, I think, in my lifetime. I've had more jobs than most families have had. And so I've lived under a lot of the policies that I write about. There are a lot of people who've never done anything except write their opinion about policies they've never worked on, never worked in, never studied, or anything like that. And it's frustrating. And that it's not obviously skull-crushing frustrating, although yeah. Metaphorically.
What is frustrating? Is. You know, I mean, you want the people that are opining on the world's greatest problems, so to speak, to actually have some life
some
experience.
Some first-hand knowledge, yeah, something. Right. And they don't in large cases. So you create an Eric Steele to get around that. He's sort of born of your frustration then.
Yes. Yes. And he's part of a program that doesn't have any of the issues that we just outlined. And so, you know, this genre itself is filled with guys that are like and the anti-hero. And I feel like anti-heroes are really popular today. I mean, and you look
hard, drinking hard.
Yeah, hard drinking.
He's
PTSD.
Nobody gets past Macho Grande. Yeah, never get over Macho Grande.
Well, right. And so Eric, from the very beginning is good. His idiosyncrasy, if you can call it that, is his goodness. And so as a storyteller and writer, the coolest, what I can do is put him in impossible situations.
At the beginning of All Out War in the first couple of chapters, he's in a liquor store. And he's ready to kick the crap out of a guy because he's abusive. And
yes.
You know, that's the kind of, he's the guy who sees the shit going down across the room and doesn't say, come on, honey, well, let's go out the back door. He says, I'm going to go and make this right or stop it from happening.
That's right. And so the theme in the first book, and I always like to write with moral questions and themes because I really think it's important to address certain aspects of our society. What the hell is the point of a story if you don't do that? Mm. And so Eric Steele, in the first book, he learns very clearly from his mentor, Demo, that you can't save everybody. Eric Steele, on every mission that he's a part of, if he's on a mission to find a nuclear bomb, a rogue nuclear weapon, if he sees a woman and child in Syria being raped, he always has a tactical acumen, strength, intelligence, whatever, to step in, save the girl, save the wife, and accomplish the mission, right? But the problem is what if the mission is somebody that you love and care about, you know? In combat, as an American soldier on the battlefield, you're in those no-win situations all the time, Derek. What if a young girl in combat walks up to your Humvee with a grenade in her hands? Do you shoot that little girl or not? Ultimately, it's a no-win situation. I mean, the hope is that you have the patience that you can identify that maybe what she's bringing you is a dud grenade that she found in her front yard. But what if she's not? And so those are the kinds of situations that I want to put the reader in along the you know, with Eric Steele, in Eric Steele's hip pocket along the way. And in book two, I run him through the ringer in book two. He's got on the forefront of his mind, is the mission worth it? Is what I'm doing out there making this country safer and better? Which is, again, if you think about it, the American troops ask themselves that question all the time because, you know, spouses, husbands, wives, parents, soldiers aren't the only ones that deploy. You know, families bear the emotional scars of a deployment too. Well, in an all-out war, Eric Steele's wondering if the mission is worth it, wondering if he's on the right path. He's having dinner with his mother to discuss just that, and he's attacked at his home. His mom is critically injured. You don't know if at the end of this attack, if she's alive or dead. And now Steele's saying, Jesus Christ, you know, here I'm wondering if the mission is worth it, and now my mom herself has been wrapped up into it. And so you know, from a symbolic standpoint, that's not unlike every mother that watches her son or daughter go to war. They bear the emotional scars. They might not be physical injuries, but they bear the emotional scars. And Steele's mom and her injuries are supposed to be emblematic of that fight. That
I don't want to give too much away in the book, but I have read it or listened to the audio version because I can't read. I'm an illiterate. But it's excellent, and I highly recommend it. I want to talk to you about the process, and then you can give away as much as you want.
Yeah.
I can't ruin
your
book.
You're a trickster, man. You had me out in the lobby. You're getting me to disclose certain plot elements.
You
want to
know the secrets of the next few books. PayPal me some money. And we
can talk. Right, exactly.
The detail of the scenarios is only matched by the details of the settings in some cases. Now, I'm just curious, as a reader and as a writer, not of fiction, but although some people think it's all BS that I write, did you go to these places to write about them?
Well, so what? No, it wasn't in the budget, right? But this book is all over the world.
Right.
I just did a ton of research on reading about the countries, the geographic layout of the countries, talking to people that have been there. And what I always say is, I just watched the very first X-Men, okay? Mm. At the end of that movie, Wolverine is fighting Sabretooth on top of the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. And I'm like, holy shit, whoever wrote that, I mean, that is awesome. Whoever wrote that, like, the writers are probably thinking this is going to be a badass scene, right? That's what I always try to do with my books, is have a badass scene in a cool location. But what makes those scenes so memorable is it's the vendetta between Wolverine and Sabretooth that really attached the viewer to those scenes. It really creates a sense of suspense as who's going to win. So I always say character.
Really. Gee, he's going to kill Wolverine and
Sabretooth and Wolverine have a really complicated relationship.
Right.
But what I'm trying to say, Derek, is that that is what makes that scene important. So character is more important than setting, even though I do try to put a lot of time and effort into the settings and making sure they're authentic.
But you describe the characters are excellent, but you when you're reading it, when you're listening to it, you're seeing it just like you would anything else. It's like a movie in your head. It's. I swear to God, I thought that you went to these places.
I didn't.
The scenes in London. Did you at least go to London?
No, I've been there before. I've been to Europe as part of being in the army. But no, I've never been to London. But I'll tell you right now, I've got great editors that tell me that the Picatinny line is not the Picatinny train. You know, in the first draft, it was the Picatinny train. You know,
well, so you don't have to tell everybody you screwed up.
I screwed up
and
a lot.
A team
of
people behind you fixing.
Well,
your
look,
things.
Man, all creativity is collaborative. You know, and I don't give a shit what anyone says. If someone's writing a fiction book, you got help doing it. Look at Michael Crichton. Michael Crichton is one of the most prolific and best fiction authors ever. He wrote some of the most creative stories ever. But the guy wasn't an archaeologist. It wasn't expert on Amber. He had those members on his team helping teach, coach, and mentor him. I have a great editorial team that's helped me every step of the way with these books. I'm not ashamed to admit it. But I did a shitload of research on these locations. Is it okay if I swear? Is it all right to swear on the podcast?
No, it's not. It's
should I have?
No, you can say whatever you want.
I'm getting thumbs up from the producer.
Yeah, he likes it.
Yeah, he likes it. So I'm just saying, like, I did a lot of research, spoke to a lot of people that have actually been there. I let them read those actual chapters. I mean, I want to – with these books, authenticity is everything.
Yes.
And so I want to make sure that I get the small details right, both tactically and geographically.
When you sat down to write Man of War – was it, this is the story, or was it, this is the first act in a story? I'm just curious, when you sit down to write All Out War, do you sit down and go, okay, what am I going to do from where I left off last time? Or do you know the puzzle piece you have to fit into the mosaic that you're working on?
I think the answer to that is a little of column A, a little of column B. Man of War, to answer your first question, was not, I mean, oh my gosh, what you read on the pages of Man of War today is the fourth or fifth iteration of that story, of me just trying to learn the style of writing fiction, moving from Outlaw Platoon, which is nonfiction, to trying to write a thriller story was monumentally challenging. Everybody loves the idea of writing fiction, but it is like learning to ride a bicycle without a seat while it's on fire. It is really hard. And I wrote four or five different beginnings, probably 100 pages into five different Steele stories that my editor was like, this isn't quite right yet. Once I found that formula, once I found the right economy of words, that's the big thing with fiction. You have to have the right economy of words. You can't over-describe both character or setting because it makes the plot lag. So you just have to strike the right balance. Once I figured that out for Man of War, the process was a lot easier. But God, man, getting that first book done was a challenge. I feel like I came into book two in a more structured way. And once I had the story done, the characters done, their histories done, both their internal, all the characters' internal conflicts and external conflicts outlined, and the world was created, I sort of knew where I wanted to start with All Out War. And I knew what pieces of the puzzle I wanted to make sure I clipped into place.
How hard is it when you sit down and you write and you have this outline, you have this idea, you have these characters, and then you're like halfway through it, you're like, oh, crap, I forgot about this, and you know, this important thing or this good idea that I had. And either you got to scrap it or you got to go back and find a way to weave it in.
Well, it's really hard because it's like once weaving in a subplot, it's not easy, you know, because subplots are they're chain reactions. One thing affects the other. It's real life. So the way I write these books is I come up with four or five kick-ass action sequences, like the most original action sequences, scene, setting, tactics that you could possibly imagine, and I use them in waypoints for my story. So I've come up with these, and I outline, do a deep dive on all of these action scenes, and I write to each waypoint. And so from those action scenes, I can develop an outline, basically a map of where I want to take the story. But the truth of the matter is, if you're a good fiction writer, right, and your characters are real people, and these are real people in my mind, characters have a say in where a story goes. So sometimes as you write, the writing process is sort of a fly by the seat of your pants.
You know what? I had him doing this, but now that he's here, he wouldn't do that.
Yes, exactly. So the characters get a say in how they get from point A to point B to point C. And so I feel like I have that battle rhythm down now. And I feel like, you know, that is why for young writers, it's so important to have a theme and a moral question. Every line of dialogue for every character that you have, if it's not serving the broader theme, then it's wasted dialogue. In other words, the theme in All Out War, and I just say this because most people probably won't realize that themes and moral questions are oftentimes unconscious things. They just we just know we like a story when we leave a movie or read a book just because. But the theme in All Out War, right, is are you a man or are you a slave? And what I tried to do with Eric Steele and Zakiya, the villain in this story, is they both are essentially the same character. They both are operators for their own government. They both have done the bidding of their own government. They both have tried to protect their own governments. But the difference is, and what Eric Steele, I think, realizes in the end of this story, is the altruism that's a part of his mission, right? The fact that he is out there trying to liberate other people, trying to save other people. And what he does is a choice, which makes him a servant, not a slave. He does it by choice, right? And that plays back into the, is the mission worth it? For Zakiya, he just resents the fact that he's been used and abused the whole time, and he's been a pawn, and he just wants to kill the kings, right? And so—
But that wasn't, he was hired for a gig.
He was, but then, he had his own ulterior motives from the beginning.
But
yes.
It's an interesting way to use the main villain. Is you sit there and then about halfway through, you're like, wait a second, is he not the main villain? Is he a mercenary?
Yeah.
What's going on? And then
Zakiya from the very first chapter has his own ulterior motives. And I thought that was important to me.
He's not one-dimensional or even two-dimensional. He's three-dimensional. He's a very interesting character.
In a perfect world, I love the villain almost as much as I love the hero.
You're a horrible person at your heart, at your core. You're a bad man.
Well, you know, what can I say? I like a good villain, you know? And Zakiya is a character that has been used and abused his whole life, and he's pissed off at the people that have done it, you know? And all, his mission is to take out the kings. He's been a pawn his whole life. He wants to kill the kings. And Eric Steele, after his mother gets hurt, you know, in this book, his mother gets hurt. Eric Steele is on a mission to kick ass and take names and find the people that hurt his mother and kill them all. But in doing so, he gets dragged into a much larger conspiracy.
Can I give away?
You could talk about whatever you want.
I'm going to set the ball on the tee, and you can decide how much to give away. But one of the things I really liked about this was the idea. Cold storage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I love the concept of it. And the name is perfect and everything.
Thank you.
But I found myself going, God, I wish this was real. I wish this was real.
Yeah, thank you. That's so cool. I love that you love that, man. So black site prisons were a big item of contention during the George W. Bush administration. Yes. CIA, black site prisons, they're all
God forbid we take people places where we can get information from them.
The global war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan was at its height. We had black site prisons outside the continental United States where they didn't necessarily have to adhere to constitutional law. Well, all of those went away, and I'm using air quotes, they went away.
They better not have gone
away. And so I just start thinking, like, what would be the most badass way to create a prison to get around all the bullshit that George W. Bush and then Barack Obama after him had to deal with the controversy of the black site prisons? The best way to do it is, like, what if I had a nuclear-powered icebreaker ship that all it did was circumnavigate the North Pole on shipping routes that are swamped with Russian ships. I did so much research on Russian shipping and shipping out of Murmansk and Arctic shipping lanes. This ship could circumnavigate the Arctic Circle up at the top, up at the North Pole, on shipping lanes that are already there, hide in plain sight, and nobody would be – no one would
blend in.
It would just blend in, and nobody would know the difference. It's a ship that houses the worst terrorists on the face of the planet, people that don't want to go – you don't want sending to Guantanamo Bay. They're too dangerous to send there. They just put them there for the rest of their life, and they try to exploit intel from them, and nobody knows why. It's in international waters. Is it a U.S. ship? I don't know. But you get all that information in this book. I'm really psyched about that idea. And cold storage, by the way, is – so it's kind of a cool name with double meaning. Cold storage is where you put all of your weapons in the military. Like, hey, go get your equipment out from cold storage. I'd tell my squad leaders or whatever, oh, you know, put your equipment in cold storage. That's what we would call it. So I'm like, that would be a badass – name for a black site prison that I wanted
it's
to put
so – much. Like, how pissed are you that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is still alive and hasn't even
been tried? Well, why isn't he on cold storage?
He wants to plead guilty.
Come on.
No, why isn't he cold? Why isn't he room temperature?
Exactly. Why is he still alive? Or why is he in New York City? Why does he get the benefits of constitutional law? Why does he get an attorney? He was captured on the battlefield.
And
killed American troops.
He admitted what he did. He's proud of it.
Look, we're at war. I mean, he should not. He's not a U.S. citizen. He should not be subject to the same constitutional protections that U.S. citizens are subject to. It's an insult. It's a slap in the face to what the founding fathers intended. We're at war. These people want to kill us. Why is he in a jail cell and in some supermax prison in New York City? I don't know. It's wrong.
Let me ask you again about the book and the... There's a lot of weapon use. There's a lot of descriptions of the weapons. Is that from firsthand? Do you do research on that?
You
haven't gone to Budapest or Tunis or whatever.
I do know my – right, no Budapest, no Tunis, but I do love weapons. And so I love 1911s. I've been obsessed with that pistol for a long time. I wanted Steele to carry that as a remnant of his relationship with his father. Eric Steele's father disappeared when he was really, really young on a mission. Eric Steele doesn't know what happened to him, but all he's left to remember his father by is this 1911 pistol. And so I just love the history of the 1911 pistol. It's basically – I look at a 1911 pistol and that just screams to me U.S. military, right? That's what we were issued – all the way back, going back to World War One. So, and yeah, every rifle in this book is a rifle that I've, you know, for the most part, I've fired on my own, you know, or carried in battle, or one of my men carried in battle, you know, where I might not have been a subject matter expert on that particular weapon system. I knew all the technical specifics of it because I was in charge of the guys who wielded it.
I want to meet Meg.
Meg, you like her? You think she's sexy?
I don't know. I haven't seen her, but I like the description.
Why do you
want
to meet her? You like her.
She's a badass. She's smart. Eric Steele has a well-rounded life.
He does.
Under normal circumstances.
He does.
But it's not. He's not this super guy where he's minding his own business and then the beeper goes off, gets the call, and immediately he jets off to the other side of the world.
Right, right. That's what I said. It's exactly. That's not what Eric Steele is. Yeah, Eric Steele, you know, he has a lot of the same daily problems that we do. And he's got a thing for Meg and Meg has a thing for him. But again, this is something that I draw right from my military experience. It's not only is Eric questioning the mission, Meg is questioning the mission. Can I have a relationship with a guy who's gone all the time? Can I get married?
In situations where he's likely to get killed. And not even possibly could get killed. He's likely to get killed. That's his job.
And never see him again and not know what happened to him. Right. And so Meg is even questioning, can I handle this? Can I get married to this man? Can I have a life with this man? Can I have kids with this man? What happens if he goes overseas and goes on a mission and never comes back? And so all these things are on her head too, on her mind as well. And, you know, I think now more than ever, I have to say Meg was a character that I think is important because, you know, I watch my daughter. She's 8. And she watches these Pixar films like Brave, or anytime there's a kick-ass female hero that just really does just kick ass and take names, you see her liven up after watching those films, and there's nothing greater than seeing her like think that she can do those things. Meg is a character written for her. You know, I want my daughter to think that she can kick ass and take names, and that's why Meg is in this book.
Which is harder to write, fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction 1,000 times over.
Which do you like writing more?
Fiction 1,000 times over. Yeah, fiction is so fun. Oh my gosh, it's so tedious and it's so challenging. It really, really is. And you truly have to love the process of creating a story and wargaming different scenarios and creating characters. I just think that there is nothing more fun, but also nothing more challenging.
Tom Clancy was famous for his descriptions and the technology of the mm-hmm. descriptions of the technology, much of which the military said, hey, that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Let's go try and do that. You have some of that in here.
Yeah.
The imagination part, how do you balance the, I could create some sort of super weapon or super drone or whatever yeah. with the, I've got to keep it in the realm of reality.
Yeah,
you can't be,
yeah.
you got to be out ahead of it.
You do.
A little bit, but not ridiculously so that they're flying cars.
Right. No, you're really touching on some really important things. Yeah. My job, I feel like, is I look at these books as faction. Yes, they're fiction, but they're based in a world of fact. You know, one of the key plot elements of this book is the U.S. embassy move in Israel to Jerusalem. That I turned in this manuscript before Donald Trump made that call. You know,
you're a witch. Burn
so,
him.
Well, you know, burn it's him. Like you look at where the political winds are blowing, and you're trying to say if we're going to stay on this path, like we might end up here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm not. And weapons are the same thing. You know, I try to look at where we are. I know when I got out of the military, they had a heads up display helmet, sort of like Halo, Master Chief in Halo, where you would have your azimuth, you'd have your 8-digit grid coordinate, it would monitor your health. And so I wrote that in book one. It was the Mark 11 jumper's helmet that helped Eric Steele do a Halo jump into Beirut. In this book, it's this thing I just made up off the top of my head called the Operator Life Support System, which is a body armor, but it also doubles at monitoring vital. It doubles at monitoring
your
vital.
It can give you a heart shock.
Yeah, right. And so it is really important to look at existing technology and figure out, you know, where we're going to go next or what would be the most beneficial thing to a U.S. soldier or a U.S. operator on the battlefield, you know? And look, we have Fitbits. We have the technology to do it. We could probably strap body armor to soldiers right now that monitored vitals and could administer a shock should a soldier go into cardiac arrest. Why can't that be real? You know?
Mm.
And so you just sort of try to take what's out there already and elevate it a little bit and you know, walk 2 or 3 years down the line and say, this is where we could be. And that's really what I try to do with these books.
Coming up with names. How hard is that? The times I've written short stories, it's like the villain is douchebaggy, you know, whatever. And then the hero is me.
Yeah.
And like, it's hard to come up with names. I've had two daughters. We named them both. I came up with both the names. That was an impossible process.
It's hard.
But you create an entire world where you want a good name. You want a great name, but you don't want it. Like when somebody hears it, they go, that's just too on the nose. You got to make it kind of realistic that you might meet this guy at the bar or something.
Yeah, well, so I can tell you what I did for Eric Steele. And by the way, all of these names were names that I had on my mind for years.
You used to dream about a guy named Eric Steele when you were a child?
Well, so I always loved the last name.
You need to talk about your childhood.
I wasn't dreaming about him as a child, but, you know, I Eric Steele was a guy that I always loved that last name. And I remember, like, right after we got extended in Afghanistan, you know, again, I always wanted to write fiction. I always wanted to do that. I've always loved fiction. Never thought I would ever be able to do it or accomplish it. But I remember seeing the new brigade commander that came in. His last name was Steele, Steele, spelled just like my character. He was like 6'8", 300 pounds. And I'm like, holy shit. If somehow I make it out of this country alive. And I have the opportunity to write a book. I'm gonna bust my ass to try to write a book every day, but that is gonna be my main character's name. And I started thinking, I'm like, well, this is perfect. I'm from the Steel City. This is perfect. And so Steel is a Pittsburgh guy, but
then you write it down and you think, but I run the risk of Steel. He's a tough guy. Like, is this too cheesy? Where it could have been like Chase Steel or something.
Yeah.
That would have been too much. Eric kind of softens it a little bit. But there is that Blake Steel here.
Yeah.
You know?
Blaze Steel. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Forged Steel is his name. Yeah, I know. I know. I worried about that for a little bit. But then I just got to a point where I was just like, the hell with it. I don't care. I don't care if people think it's cheesy. But I mean, even Rockford. I mean,
yeah, the president's names. Both of them, a little bit.
Rockford and Cole. Cole's named, President Cole's named after one of my soldiers in Afghanistan that I lost. I mean, Zakayev is a character that I've had in my mind for the last 5 years. You know, I always wanted to write a Chechen terrorist, you know, that.
Why do you hate Chechens?
I think they're badass. We fought them in Afghanistan and they were some of the toughest, most tenacious light infantry men that you'd ever fight. I mean, they were amazing. You know, your average Chechen soldier has 10 or 15 years combat experience on an American soldier, not young 18-year-old private. I mean, and so I always thought, man, you know, a Chechen super terrorist would be a really, really great villain. And, you know, oftentimes these Chechens, like, yeah, they're Muslim, but they aren't hardliners at all. They're just straight killers. And so I've yet to see a Chechen villain, a free-thinking villain that wasn't a slave to some sort of ideology in a book before. It just hasn't happened. So that's what Zakayev is. I mean, he's just – I've had that name on my mind for a very, very long time. So
it's very, very interesting. We're out of time. The book is All Out War. I'm going to ask you to sign these.
And I will.
I want you to sign that as well for me. And you can enter to win if you send me a copy of the receipt that you bought this already. You get entered twice for the signed copy. So you get that going for you. Sean Parnell, All Out War, best of luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you, man. And I hope we'll be back for the three-peat next year.
Right. Off camera. I know what's going to happen, I think. Yeah. Maybe not. I don't know. But I recommend this book highly. And tell me about this guy who does your audiobook.
Oh, R.C. Bray is amazing. I don't know
awesome.
Why.
He's awesome.
I say it all the time.
Get the audiobook.
He's amazing. I got to say, he brings Man of War and All Out War to life. He is an award-winning audiobook reader. And I don't think that there is any other person in the world better than he is at reading fiction. And he reads my books. He's dedicated to Eric Steele and his saga. And, oh, man, I'm lucky to have him. He's great. And the audiobooks, they really are. This isn't me just, like, pimping my own product. But
no,
he really does bring the story to life. I mean,
Harper
he does.
Harper is my publisher as well. They sent me the advance of the audio. And I loved it so much. I would find myself spending more time in the car because I was listening in the car. It's on my phone, so I couldn't listen to it at home very well. That I bought Man of War.
Dude, that's
audio
awesome.
Version.
And it's great.
This guy's doing it too?
Yeah.
I want that too.
R.C. Bray's amazing. I can't thank him enough for all the great work that he does for me. And like I said, he brings Eric Steele and all of his adventures to life for sure.
Well, you do that.
I try my best. It's like, I feel like R.C. Bray really just elevates the story in some really great ways.
If they're like Oscars for audiobooks.
He would be the best,
absolutely. Sean Parnell, the book All Out War. Best of luck to
Thanks,
you, my
man.
Friend.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming
to town.
I'll
be back next year, whether you want me or not.
Well, we'll see.
Maybe drinking something a little cooler than Bud Light.
Maybe you'll have to bring down some of that Leinenkugel swill with yourself, because D.C. has standards and we don't allow it here. Thanks for watching. Thanks for telling a friend. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
And these kids who come and they end up doing well, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.